Hey Siri, play the 21st. No, I said play the 21st. If you struggle with your smart device, then imagine if your digital assistant did everything for you.
I walk into work in the morning. Here's what I see.
Hi Eric. No one has stopped by to see you since we last talked. Catch you later. Bye bye.
That's Microsoft researcher Eric Horvitz speaking during a 2013 TEDx talk. Today, he talks about artificial intelligence, its potential possibilities and problems. In politics, the Civic Federation's Lawrence Massal shares his solutions for a state budget and will debut a new campaign finance tracker from ProPublica Illinois. Plus, we continue our series of conversations with candidates for Illinois governor today, State Senator Daniel Biss.
Here in Illinois, the middle class and the working poor are being nickeled and dimed because the system doesn't ask enough of the wealthy, and I'm running for governor to change that.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For your simple needs, Siri, Alexa, any of your Google Home devices can be a great assistant. But if you ask her to add something to your calendar or to play a song, she can usually handle it. I sometimes have success. I don't know what my success ratio is with that. But imagine trying to have a full conversation with her. Researchers at Microsoft are working on ways to do that and much more. Artificial intelligence, or AI as it's called, is actually already used a lot in our lives, but it has the potential to impact us in so many other ways. Eric Horvitz is an expert in artificial intelligence. He's a director at Microsoft Research Labs. He helped start a 100-year AI study at Stanford and contributed to a new book called The Future Computed, Artificial Intelligence and Its Role in Society for Microsoft. He's in the Champaign-Urbana area to address computer science students at the University of Illinois, and he's with me now in our Urbana studio to tell us a little bit more about his research. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So, Eric, I think AI in pop culture, we have sort of a sense of what we think it means. Right. And of course, there's even a Steven Spielberg movie called AI. And I don't know if you hate the movie Terminator and the whole idea of Skynet and AI destroying our world. But in real life, how much are we using AI or interacting with it without even realizing it?
There's an amazing amount of what I would call AI under the hood. And it's been there for a couple of decades now or even more. For example, it's amazing to understand that all of our handwritten addresses right now in the United States are zooming through a system, saving millions of dollars a year, looking at reading addresses automatically, no matter how poorly you write them.
By the Postal Service.
By the Postal U.S. Postal Service. This has been in place since the late 90s. If you use a Windows laptop, the machine continues to learn about you privately in the privacy of your own laptop, and it's always guessing your next move, and it's pre-launching and pre-fetching to make things faster so it's there when you touch a key or launch an application, using the really nice, fun machine learning, as it's called.
So I think when some people hear that, they probably freak out. Like, that sounds a little creepy that your machine is learning a little bit about you. Can you explain a little bit more about what predictive learning is and what it's designed to do?
Well, I think concerns arise because a lot of AI these days is fueled by data, including data that we generate when we use the web, for example. So it's very important for companies like Microsoft and competitors like Google and Facebook to make sure that the data is kept private, is people understand how it's being used, they buy off on it when they sign up for a service, it's deleted over time and so on, and handled very carefully. But the idea basically is we try to learn to predict, to provide, to personalize news feeds, to understand how to diagnose diseases from symptoms by looking at large data sets. So let's go back to that medical example. I've been involved with several projects where we've taken, with very, very strict privacy policies, large amounts of data over like 15 years of a hospital to try to understand how to build a system that can predict based on symptoms of this patient coming in the emergency room or in the hospital, what's going to happen next? What are the highest risks? What diseases are present? And you can do this with systems that learn how to pool this data into these we call predictive models that then can be applied in a personal way for a particular patient, for example. Will this patient be readmitted in 30 days after they're discharged, which is a very important risk? And we have systems that we created that can do that kind of reasoning, pooling over a decade of data from hospital records.
And so that all falls under the rubric of AI. How do you think the layperson should think about what artificial intelligence is and what it means?
Well, back in 1956 or so, the phrase artificial intelligence, AI, was first used in terms of a proposal for a summer workshop at Dartmouth, where folks were going to get together and solve lots of problems that summer to figure out how to solve problems that were in the domain of human beings, things that required people to solve. And they talked about the challenges of understanding language, of seeing, perceiving, of planning and decision-making, and learning, adapting over time with information and observations. And so they took these pillars and they said, let's try to build a field. Now people, we look at this as looking towards a science, an actual science of intelligence, like an aerodynamics for decision-making and perception. In some ways, we're touching, and this was what people get sensitive about, we're touching up against a realm of that's been the domain or dominion of humans in terms of human intellect. We're getting better at doing things that we always thought we needed people to do.
So there's a great example of this. You gave a TEDx talk in Austin a couple years ago, and you have an assistant at your office at Microsoft. At your door. And so how does this, before we play the interaction, is this assistant, is it just an interface that comes up when someone comes to your door, or is it just a voice that talks to you?
Oh, no, there's a beautiful or handsome, depending on the day. We use male and female. We even change skin color to not have one particular persona, but as a floating head on a little screen on a pole by my door.
Okay.
And this, it's actually, you know, it's generated to not be exactly human-like. It's kind of a little cartoony, but the system can see, hear, interact with dialogue. It knows my calendar, knows important email coming in, understands how busy I am by looking at my desktop activity and listening to my office to see if I'm chatting with somebody. And it actually works with people to schedule appointments, tell them where I might be, when I might be coming back, how to get in touch with me, takes messages. So it actually will say, well, he's not here, but you want to tell me what's up? And it'll nod his head and listen and then let me know later.
So let's hear a little bit of an interaction. And what's the name of your assistant?
You know, we had names. We decided to back off and say, the assistant.
Okay, so this is the assistant interacting with a Microsoft intern.
Here's Johanna.
Hi.
Are you here looking for Eric?
Yep.
Eric is talking with someone.
I can see that.
And this might take a while.
Oh.
But I don't think he'd mind a brief interruption right now. Okay. You could check back in 15 minutes or so, and we could see if he's available then.
Okay.
So what we don't get for that, we'll tweet out the link so everyone can watch the video, because there's these priceless expressions that she has on her face when she's interacting with your assistant, where the look of horror on her face when she says, oh, you can interrupt him now. You can very clearly, like, she's just like, I don't want to do that. That to me is an interesting example, though, of the way that we're relating to all. So there's sort of like the human side of this, and then there's the machine side of this. How do you think our lives have adapted? I'm even thinking of just even all the connected home devices that we've seen in the past couple of months. Like, I realize I've adapted my language to talk to Alexa, because when I'm talking to her, if I speak like a normal person, she won't understand me.
You know, the part of the technology and the push is to make these interfaces more natural. Even today, and I'll be talking about this today to students here at UIUC, that's several years old. The assistant by my door, we've worked really hard, in fact, with some great interns that have joined us to make her more natural, or him more natural, in terms of facial expressions, understanding the nuances of conversation. So the technology, I think, will come along a long way over time to join us and be more natural over time. People can expect, I think, over the next 5 to 7 years or so, for these devices, you know, whether it be the Cortana or Siri, Alexa, to start having more natural conversations that actually go beyond command, like set timer or next meeting. More like talking about the weather and getting to the airport on time, and the way we talk to friends and colleagues, multiple topics popping and pushing, as we call them, on a stack in a natural way. we will be having actual fluid conversations with intelligences that are here to support us in various ways. And some will be very much like personal butlers.
I'm speaking with Eric Horvitz. He's a technical fellow and he's the director at Microsoft Research Labs. And when we think about that, it's a couple years old now, an incident with a bot that Microsoft created, Tay, that was released out onto the world via Twitter. And for people who don't know, like in less than 24 hours after her arrival on Twitter, she had gained more than 50,000 followers. And the problem was she started mimicking their language and voicing some fairly awful sentiments about Nazi sympathies and anti-female language, just bad language in general. And I wonder, would you consider that artificial intelligence? What did you all learn from that at Microsoft in terms of how this, the interplay will happen between people and machines?
Well, let me first say that that system in particular wasn't a deep piece of AI. It was largely a rule-based powered system, but that doesn't mean the learnings, the teachings don't go deep for AI systems or any advanced technology we put out into the world to interact with people and society more broadly in terms of being very careful at thinking deeply through a technology and its influences, being very humble about the complex admixture of when you add human beings to a technology. You really can't predict how it's going to go sometimes. You have to watch carefully. You have to be able to pull back, modify, refine technology. At Microsoft, about a year ago, we created a committee called Ether. It stands for AI and Ethics in Engineering and Research. It has a set of subcommittees that span all the way from how do we think about sensitive uses of AI, like visual recognition, facial recognition systems in sensitive areas like criminal justice and policing? How do we think about biases that might show up in these systems when they're used to give advice, when the data sets they learn from might be biased in terms of race and gender, in particular, you know, poor representation of minorities in those systems, among other challenges? And then can we build safe, robust or trustworthy systems that can explain themselves to people that people will come to trust because for good reasons? You know, I'm one of the rare AI aficionados that's been in a Tesla autopilot accident, you know, where my own car hit something that it shouldn't have hit while I was on the phone after I came to trust it over a period of months on the same street. These are really interesting issues as we build and field technologies that will come into our lives, especially in areas that are safety critical, like healthcare, transportation.
So what kind of things are you telling the students, the future engineers of today? I'm fascinated by what I can't imagine what's going on at the University of Illinois in terms of engineering and computer science, certainly a lot of cutting edge research. What kind of things are you telling the engineers who are learning all of this now?
Well, the first thing I do I'll do today in my talk is talk about why I am inspired by this area. I think this technology is going to have so many impressive and deep benefits to humanity. Agriculture. We have systems now that can help farmers to do precision agriculture, to understand their soils, that can watch over and fuse information and make predictions as to even, you know, when to sow crops given many different feeds coming in, healthcare, accessibility. I think that I've just been so impressed with some technologies that we've been able to feel, just even though they're preliminary, that help people who are sight impaired to see better. Now, at the same time, after we go through the positives, I like to sort of say, let's take a deep breath and step back and always consider the possible rough edges that might come along.
And as we think about that, Eric, I'm just wondering in terms of as we're thinking about all of this technology, you mentioned something about news feeds. Certainly that's been part of the conversation about how we get our news. There's technology that exists out there now where you can actually even just use facial recognition and create complete fake news of, like, it looks like the president is saying something they're not. So for people who are worried about all of those counters, how are technology companies like Microsoft trying to work against that?
Stepping back again, you know, would we give up fire as humanity, even though it's being applied in in cruel and unsurprising ways. We still have the world of civilization, electricity and machines. Technologies are fairly neutral. We have to worry about criminal uses of AI, just like we have to worry about criminal uses of anything or malevolent usages. I and my wife funded, and we endowed Stanford about 6 years ago or so, 5 years ago now, on a study called the 100-Year Study of Artificial Intelligence. If you go to that website, ai100.stanford.edu, you can read a framing memo we created with 18 areas of concern. Now, one of those areas of concern we called AI democracy and freedom. Could these systems, these precision reasoning systems that learn from data, learn how to manipulate human minds, whether it be through creating new kinds of imagery, as you suggested, which can be done now, or through just understanding what to say to you over time, over weeks or months from multiple aspects of your life, to shift your beliefs, to obfuscate something, to make you think differently. We have evidence now that's possible, I would like to raise our awareness of this possibility and then think through what might best protect people, what might best protect our individuality, our independence of thought, our democracy, or democracies across the world, when malevolent uses of AI could be powerful and could be manipulative.
Lots to think about. We will tweet out those links that Eric mentioned if you're interested in learning a little bit more about it. Eric Horvitz is a technical fellow and director at Microsoft Research Labs in town. Thanks for being with me, Eric. I appreciate it.
It was fun talking to you.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, publisher of scholarly and regional interest books and journals, allowing local and global readers to understand and engage with the changing world. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, Governor Rauner presented his proposal for a state budget almost immediately. Actually, even before he spoke, there were disagreements about the numbers.
Right, and that's inaccurate. It's actually, the number is $2.3 billion. Just because you ignore the number doesn't mean that the number does not exist. And this is not a number that my office made up. These are, in fact, numbers supplied to our office by all of the governor's state agencies. And they add up to what is essentially $2.3 billion in deficit spending.
That's Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza speaking to us last week in Springfield before the budget address, talking about the difference in deficit spending numbers between her office and the governor, more than $1 billion difference. While Governor Rauner has presented different numbers, one thing is clear, our state is billions of dollars in the hole. How are we going to get out? How about taxing retirement income, reducing pension benefits, possibly closing a state university? That's among the recommendations from the Independent Civic Federation. Its president, Lawrence Massal, is with me now to talk about these proposals. Lawrence, thanks for being with me. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So, Lawrence, we're going to get into some of the specifics of your plan, but it's full of lots of ideas that in many ways are not palatable to anyone of any persuasion, whether you're liberal or conservative or progressive or libertarian. How did you all come up with these solutions, and how much does it reflect how dire of a situation we're in?
So the Civic Federation attempts every year to present what we call the roadmap for Illinois' financial future, and it's an attempt to provide to the governor and the legislature the magnitude of the problem that they face and come up with serious recommendations that fit the magnitude of the solution that we believe is necessary to stabilize. The state has had a history of taking politically attractive and easy answers to complicated problems that then don't end up fixing the problem. Although they're very popular, things like taxing video poker or other things that were supposed to fund our capital needs were easily passed with large majorities in the General Assembly, but they didn't get the job done in terms of stabilizing the state's finances.
I played some of that audio of Comptroller Mendoza, who had different numbers in the governor's budget office. What's your advice to the average taxpayer who might be listening and understandably maybe perhaps confused by hearing all of these different numbers?
Right. So it's too much to expect the average taxpayer to pay attention to the details of the entire state budget, the $38 billion spending plan. However, what you should pay attention to is those areas where the state is not paying its bills, where the state is borrowing instead of having enough revenue to pay its bills, and where the state is paying, in the case of the, unpaid bills, sometimes as much as 9 or 12%. And then sometimes in order to avoid that 12% penalty for having $12 billion in unpaid bills, the state will go into the credit markets and borrow additional money to bring down that payment. That might make sense financially in the short term, but it's enormously expensive. And it's all spending that has nothing to do with the priorities of most citizens, which would be to put the money in the schoolrooms, in the classrooms, or in public safety. This is just financing Illinois' recklessness, and it's very expensive.
And so to that point, to the expensive part of this, what are your recommendations in this fiscal roadmap for taxes, especially in regards to retirement income?
Well, so right now, the state of Illinois is operating with a 4.95% income tax for all Illinoisans that was passed last summer. That was one of the key components that ended what was called the budget impasse. That is generating about $6 billion in new revenue to the state of Illinois, but the state is spending more than that $6 billion increase. The state ran up $15 billion in unpaid bills during the last impasse, which lasts just over 2 years. So the recommendation is that make sure that your revenues and your expenditures balance to the best of your ability. It's basically budgeting 101. It's something that 49 other states do on an annual basis. Illinois did not, for over 2 years, have a budget. It was basically operating under court orders, ignoring the constitutional requirement that there be appropriations for any state spending, and it ended up costing us a great deal of money. In order to make up what is basically now about a $4 billion shortfall that the state faces and pay down the unpaid bills, which now stand at about $9 billion after the state borrowed $6 billion and will take 12 years to pay them off, in order to bring the state into a stable revenue with enough money to pay all the known expenses that are expected, the state needs to look at the very generous exemption that we provide for retirement income. Illinois is the only Midwest state, only Great Lakes state, that does not provide some taxation of retirement income. The federal government taxes your retirement income. Only two states, Pennsylvania and Mississippi, which have income taxes, have as generous an exemption as Illinois has. And that's leaving over $2 billion on the table for a state that's paying twice that amount in its unpaid bills.
Wow. So that would, to your mind, help solve at least half of the immediate problem. There's something else you mentioned, and this is talked about a lot, and I wonder if you can explain this a little bit for folks. Illinois has more units of government than any other state in the U.S. How would consolidating that help save us on the money side as well?
It's obvious. You know, if you look at the fact that Illinois has been in trouble and the fact that we have 6,978 units of government, that's more than twice as many as any other state. There's a reason why other states are not continuing the model that we created over 100 years ago. It's because it's expensive and it's inefficient to deliver the government services. Consolidating will save operating costs. Consolidating will allow you to reduce your administrative overhead and still deliver quality services. Whether it's the large number of school districts that Illinois has compared to our surrounding states, or it's outdated governments such as townships, what mosquito abatement districts, and others that could be consolidated into the general government. Illinois relies heavily on property taxes to fund these local governments, especially schools. So any inefficiency or unnecessary cost that you can drive out of the local governments could provide property tax relief or be used more efficiently to put the property tax revenues into the classrooms rather than into administrative overhead.
I'm speaking with Lawrence Massal, president of the Civic Federation. We're talking about their roadmap for Illinois. What about spending? How do you think we can get that under control?
You need to have a reasonable understanding of how much of the state spending is set before even the legislature convenes.
And do we
contracts
do that?
Exist. Well, they're in terms of looking at what the state can do in terms of cutting. If you say we're going to eliminate large areas of state government, you need to be able to identify how the state's going to exist without those services. Not spending money, not having a budget, not having appropriations for your employee health care as we had for the last 2 years is not the same as saving money. You're incurring liabilities. So first off, the Civic Federation believes that we have to put a limit. That's our top priority in our roadmap, to limit the rate of growth of agency discretionary spending to 2%. That means that that's a very tough number for a state agency to operate, because most of their employment contracts have built into them increases that were negotiated in previous years far larger than 2%. So it's a fairly reasonable cut to agency operations, but it's necessary in order to make up for the fact that we have almost $9 billion in unpaid bills right now. We have to pay down those bills.
And when you mention unnecessary things, Lawrence, one of the other things that I think might have been a surprise for people, especially people who followed your roadmap for a couple of years, is the idea that perhaps you think we should think about closing some of our state universities?
It's a very unfortunate but fact that most observers who look at Illinois' student population and look at our overall population see that we're going to continue to see a decline in high school graduates, and that those are the people that would be most obvious to fill the many universities, the 9 public universities that we have in Illinois and our community colleges. This isn't something that was created because of the budget impasse, the drop in student population. Most of our major universities have seen a significant drop in student population over the last 10 years. Most of our surrounding states, all of the Great Lakes states, all of the Midwest is seeing a dwindling or a diminishment of their college-ready high school graduates coming out of their population. We have backfilled that at some of the major state universities with foreign students from China and India, but there's also pressure now at the national level to really examine what the benefit is for those students and whether they're going to be allowed to stay. We're calling on the governor and the General Assembly to set up a bipartisan commission to look realistically at how many overlapping schools, universities that we have that have similar programs, that have similar demands on for the state population, that are competing rather than cooperating. We need to get to the point where we're realistic that we're not going to see a surge in college aged Illinois students, and we're going to have to recognize that we need to be more effective in how we fund our universities, recognize our key advantages, prioritize, and make sure that the money is being well spent. We can continue down the path that we've been on for the last 3 to 5 years, where we ignore the fact that many of our colleges and universities are losing population. We can say that it's based on the MAP grant underfunding, but we don't have the evidence to back that up. And when we look at other states, we see they're under the same pressure. That's why so many students from Illinois schools are going to surrounding state universities and are being afforded very attractive and competitive packages, because there's great demand for those students. We're just saying that you should prioritize for what's the most long-term benefit to the state of Illinois, which colleges, universities, and programs should be prioritized.
There's lots of proposals in this budget roadmap. We've tweeted out a couple links to that. We'll have all of that information on Twitter as well as at our website, 21stshow.org. I want to thank Lawrence for being with us, president of the Civic Federation. Thanks, Lawrence.
Thank you so much.
Speaking of money, the 2018 race for Illinois governor could be the most expensive in U.S. history. We're not even at the primary, and more money has been raised than any previous election cycle in Illinois. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, and tracking who's spending what is the goal of a new online tool developed by ProPublica Illinois. It's actually something we've embedded on our website. So if you head to 21stshow.org, you can see it. It's on the right side of the page. And the person who made that, David Eads, is on the line with us. He's a ProPublica Illinois news developer. Hey, David. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you. You know, I used to work for NPR, but they never let me on the radio. So this is great. And thank you for embedding our widget.
No problem. So we're already at the most expensive governor's race in history. David, how much money are we talking about?
We are talking about a tremendous amount of money. So about $145 million have been raised as of today. And we're still 4 weeks from the primary. We can't really know what the historic dimensions of this will be until all is said and done. But what we do know is that Bruce Rauner had raised $14 million heading into the primary in 2014, and he had $75 million this time around.
Wow.
That's actually more than he spent in the entire 2014 campaign.
And that's how much he already has raised before we're almost a month from the primary. So what does this tracker do that you all built? Can you explain what it is if people go? So if you go to our website, 21stshow.org, you can take a look at it. But what does it do, David?
Right. So listeners can see this at the 21stshow.org. The widget is a piece of technology that any publication or really anyone who has a website can embed on a page and a story. And the idea here is to create some sort of ambient awareness around the fundraising situation to sort of tell this miniature story, provide some context to reporting, to provide some context to listeners as they're listening to a show like the 21st Show. So it's an experiment. It's an experiment in complementing the politics reporting that's already happening around the state. There's great politics reporting happening all around the state. With this piece of useful, data-driven visual journalism, something that will hook people, that will keep them reading the story, that will make them interested, but also helps tell the story, helps you understand just the scale of fundraising that we're looking at.
Right. So you mentioned, for example, for Bruce Rauner, he's already raised $75 million. What about J.B. Pritzker? How much money is in his campaign? Those are the two sort of big money, not just for their personal money, but just in terms of this campaign, they also are the biggest finance things going on, right? Oh, sorry. It looks like we've lost David. As I said, that tracker is at 21stshow.org as we try to get him back. It basically, the whole idea of it is for you to track the money that's being raised in this race. If you stand by just a minute, we're hoping we can get David back. So David's back with us. David, as we were just saying, so it looks like Bruce Rauner, I'm just pulling up the tracker here. It looks like Bruce Rauner's raised, as you said, $75.2 million. J.B. Pritzker, he's at $56.2 million. How much of this is self-funded? You're going to start adding that to your tracker as well, right?
We're going to start, so we'll start adding that to our tracker. So in Pritzker's case, the vast majority of it is $56.2 million. I don't have the exact amount. It's a little tricky to pull out of the data, which is why we're rolling it out later. But yeah, so the vast majority of his money is self-funded. Rauner got a $20 million contribution from Ken Griffin last summer, but for the most part is also self-funded. And one thing that you'll see with J.B. Pritzker is that as the heat has sort of turned on and the Democratic primary has gotten closer, he's dumped $14 million into his campaign over the last 30 days.
Yeah, and you can actually just see that if you look. So we'll tweet out a picture of what this looks like. If you go to our website, you can see it as well. David, I'm afraid we're out of time, but just very quickly, this data comes from the Illinois State Board of Elections. Is that correct?
This comes from the Illinois State Board of Elections, and there's a great resource, not run by us, but called illinoissunshine.org, where you can look up this information for any race.
Right, and that has more detailed information as well. We'll tweet all of that out. David Eads is with ProPublica Illinois. He's a news developer. David, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Leading up to the primary race for governor, the election's on March 20th, we've recorded interviews with 7 of the 8 candidates and have started to air them. Just a note to our audience, we've reached out to Governor Rauner's office a number of times to have him join us on the show. We have not received a response. He's welcome to join us anytime. Today, I'm joined by Daniel Biss, a state senator representing Illinois' 9th Senate District. That includes parts of Chicago's North Side and northern suburbs, including Evanston, Wilmette, and Northbrook. Before that, he served one term in the Illinois House. He was also, prior to that, a math professor at the University of Chicago. He's one of 6 Democrats running for governor. Senator Biss, welcome back to the 21st.
It's great to be back, Nyla.
Illinois went more than 2 years without a full budget, as you well know. We know that most of the vulnerable people in our state were hit hard in many ways. They're still recovering. Why should voters entrust you with helping to make sure that doesn't happen again?
Well, we need a budget. We need a stable budget, and we need a budget that actually works for ordinary people in the state of Illinois. Bruce Rauner, as you said, has failed in a record-breaking way as we had a 2-year, 6-day budget impasse. And honestly, no other governor in the history of the country has done something quite like that. So the bar that we ought to set for our governor isn't just have a budget, but have a budget that works. We have a system in Illinois that has been really biased in favor of the very wealthy, biased in favor of big corporations, has left middle-class families like mine and the working poor further and further behind. And so we need not only a budget, but a budget with a fair tax system, a budget that does not overburden the middle class and the working poor, a budget that invests in schools in every zip code, not just a few parts of Illinois, a budget that allows access to universal health care, and a budget that invests in child care and family leave. If we do that right, we'll have a state that works for the rest of us. That's what I believe in. That's what my campaign is about. And that's what I've been fighting for in the legislature.
So you mentioned taxes. Let's talk about that for a minute. It's obviously been a prominent issue as the state looks for more revenue. Last year, we saw our individual income tax rate go from 3.75% to 4.95%. The corporate tax rate went up to 7%. You've said you'd like to do away with this flat tax rate for individuals. Can you give us some more specifics?
You bet. We have to do away with that. Illinois is one of only 4 states whose constitution says you have to have a flat income tax, whose constitution says that, hey, even though Bruce Rauner made $188 million in 2015, it's unconstitutional to ask him to pay a higher rate than a teacher or a nurse. That doesn't make sense. It's not fair. It's not consistent with our modern economy, and it's not what our state needs. And so we need to repeal that provision so that we can have a tax system that works for ordinary working families, that allows us to bring down property taxes and allows us to tax the very wealthy so that we can afford to fully fund our schools and healthcare and human services. If we were to get that done, we would have a state that actually works for ordinary families. But we haven't done that for so long because of who's in control in Springfield, because of who pays for the election campaigns, and because of the strong political power that the very wealthy have. Our campaign is about reversing that and about handing power back to ordinary people so we have a state that lifts people up across Illinois.
So that said, do you believe the current tax income tax rate is too high on lower and middle income residents?
I do. I do. And I think that we have been handcuffed with a tax system that says, even though for the last several generations, almost all the new money in the economy has gone to the top, while middle class families and the poor have not gotten a raise, even though that's the reality we live in, it's not been possible for the tax system to follow that reality and ask the wealthy to pay more without overburdening the middle class and the working poor.
So you've also proposed to that end a LaSalle Street tax. That would be for financial transactions?
That's absolutely right. There are incredible numbers of dollars that are cycled through the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange, and we don't tax them at all. When you go buy a screwdriver at the hardware store, you pay 6.25% sales tax to the state, but when a $100 million trade is done at the Board of Trade, there is not a nickel of tax paid, and that just doesn't make sense. Listen, Nyla, the economy has moved. The economy has changed. The financial sector has ballooned. That's where the money is. And because we don't touch those dollars, we don't have a state government that can afford to invest in people without overburdening the middle class and the poor. And this question of taxing financial transactions is a profound difference in the race, where the other candidates say they're against it. They say that it's impractical. And what I would say is, if we're not going to build a tax system that works for the modern economy, we're not going to have a state that works for our modern society. And to have people who have basically become experts in explaining how the wealthy can get out of paying their fair share of taxes, tell us that we can't start to ask them to pay their fair share does not make any sense to me.
Senator Biss, you've also called for a single-payer health care system in Illinois. How would that work?
Here's how that would work. I believe that health care is a right, not an option, not a privilege. I believe that everyone has a right to health care, and the best and most efficient way to do it is with a single-payer system like Medicare, where that one payer can negotiate with pharmaceutical companies to bring down prices, can wring the incredible inefficiencies created by the for-profit health insurance industry out of the system, over time save significant dollars. Now, it would take a real transformation to get there. It'll require new revenue, which is why I support the LaSalle Street tax, and we'll have to be creative in working with the federal government to repurpose federal dollars that are used for things like Medicare and Medicaid and federal employee health insurance and veterans benefits to fund that system. But listen, this works in other countries. This is the morally right thing to do because healthcare should be a right and not an option. And we need for a state to be bold and lead the way to show the country it's possible. That's what our country needs, and that's what I think Illinois should be doing.
I'm speaking with State Senator Daniel Biss, who is running for governor. You mentioned the federal government. Obviously, another big issue we're seeing is in regards to immigration. Do you think state resources should be used to help enforce federal immigration law when it comes to detention and deportation?
No, I don't. I was proud to support the Trust Act that has now been signed into law, and I support strengthening it. It was actually watered down during the course of passage. Let's be clear here. Donald Trump is attacking immigrant communities across Illinois and across the country, and in so doing, making our state weaker, and in so doing, hurting our state's economy, and in so doing, most importantly, trampling on the fundamental rights of people in very vulnerable positions across Illinois. Our state government needs to stand with immigrants. Our state government needs to stand with our people and not target our people by collaborating with the federal government. Oh, by the way, if we want to be economically successful, we have got to be a place that people from around the world want to flock to. And being a place that welcomes immigrants is a very important part of that.
You mentioned people flocking to Illinois. We've been asking our listeners on social media to chime in with questions that they wanted to ask. And we got a question from Reddit that I imagine is the mind of many people in our state. Why do you think Illinois' population has declined at a higher rate than any other state for the past few years?
It's a series of factors, and we've got to address all of them. Number one, we didn't have a budget for 2 years and 6 days under Bruce Rauner, and that created instability and uncertainty. It meant that vendors didn't get paid. It meant that people got laid off. Of course, that expelled people. Number two, when Bruce Rauner wasn't funding our community colleges and universities at all for years, that sent students elsewhere across state borders. Bruce Rauner has been a terrible governor for Illinois, but one of the best governors that the University of Wisconsin could have ever hoped for. So that's part of it. But part of it goes back way before Bruce Rauner. Part of it goes back to a system that was fiscally unstable, so people didn't trust Illinois. Part of it goes back to a system here in Illinois that was really great for billionaires and not so great for middle-class families like mine. And that meant that families were burdened by high property taxes, and yet their schools weren't adequately funded and started to flee the state. If we want a state that people are going to come to from across the nation and across the world. Oh, and by the way, Illinois has the tools and the assets and the extraordinary people to be exactly that state. If we want to be that state, we need to have a system that works for ordinary families. We need to have a system that's fair for middle-class families and the working poor. And we need to have a budget that's sustainable over the long term so people have some faith in the long-term stability of our government.
The state of public education has suffered in the past few years, whether we're talking about K-12 school funding and the most inequitable system in the country or our state's largest universities. And of course, last year, the state agreed to overhaul the funding formula for public schools to make it more equitable. That bill also came with a new private school scholarship tax credit. Some Democrats said while they didn't like that part of the bill, it was worth it in order to get the new funding formula in place. You did not agree with them. You voted no on the entire bill. Why?
Well, I think we need to be willing to draw lines in the sand on core values questions. And to me, sending public dollars to private schools to line the pockets of the wealthy and ultimately weaken the public school system, that's a red line. I just can't get comfortable doing that. And even though there were other things in the bill that I liked, I'm not going to vote for a bill that does that.
So to be clear, for you saying setting up a scholarship fund and allowing for a tax credit for private schools to you is putting public dollars into private school funding.
100%, because those tax credits are taken directly from the public treasury. If it weren't for that program, that would be $75 million in the public treasury that we could use to fund schools. But because of that program, it's $75 million in the pockets of the wealthy instead of in our public school system. That's a trade-off I cannot live with. But I'll tell you this, Nyla. Though I was really happy about certain parts of the bill, we have so much work to do when it comes to fixing our school funding system. That bill made important changes to the kind of existing school funding system, but leaves in place a system that is more property tax reliant than any other state, which means higher property taxes and more inequitable school funding. If we want to truly solve this problem, we have to get at that root cause. Change our tax system, stop overburdening property taxpayers, bring in adequate revenue to the state treasury by actually taxing the wealthy fairly, and then use that money to fund schools properly in every corner of the state, not just a few. And that is something that other states get right and we get very, very wrong. And it's time for us to get it right, because generations of school children are being left behind by a system that is fundamentally unfair.
Senator Biss, all of these things you're talking about, changing school funding, the corporate tax rate, the LaSalle Street tax, in the case of the individual income tax, that's something that's in our Constitution. All of these things require working both across the aisle and within your own party. And that's actually another question that we got from Reddit. How do you plan to do that to make sure things actually get done?
I'm really proud to be the only candidate in this race who's ever gotten a bill passed in the Illinois State Legislature. I'm proud to be the only candidate in this race who's had to make tough calls in the Illinois State Legislature. I've passed almost 90 bills into law. That includes bills that people thought would never pass. That includes bills that special interests opposed, but I was able to beat them by building a strong coalition. That includes reaching across the aisle to find a few Republican votes, for example, for LGBTQ-friendly bills. Knowing the way the legislative process works, knowing the players, having relationships with Democrats and Republicans in both the House and the Senate is just irreplaceable. You can't buy that. You can't learn that by instinct. You can only walk in the door with that set of skills if you've done the years of work to get there. And so I am very, very confident that of the candidates in the race, I am the one with the knowledge and relationships to actually move a bold transformational agenda. But understand this, Nyla. It's never going to work if it's just being done by me and 177 legislators in a vacuum. We're going to need people across Illinois to stand with us and demand it. I've been so honored to travel the state and participate in hundreds of town halls and listen to people and hear people and include people in a new kind of grassroots campaign. And when we win the election in March and in November, we're not going to stop. We're going to stay together as a grassroots movement across the state and use that energy to help move the legislature and embolden the legislature to do the kinds of transformational progressive things that our state sorely needs. We have been told for generations about what's impossible, and this campaign is about changing what's possible.
You've told us a lot about what you will want to do. Why do you want to be governor?
I think this is a unique moment for our state. It's a unique moment for our country, and it's a unique moment for the Democratic Party. We get to decide who we're going to be. Are we going to be a billionaire party? Are we going to be a people's party? Are we going to have elections, or are we going to have auctions? Are we going to have a celebrity form of politics, or are we going to actually make decisions based on values and experience? And if we get those decisions right, we have a chance to make generational changes here in Illinois. We have a chance to build the kind of Illinois that people will flock to, because people should flock to our beautiful and extraordinary state. We can have an Illinois that works for working families. We could have an Illinois that lifts people up across the state. I have never seen a moment with such extraordinary opportunities to make fundamental change for the 13 million people who live here, and it will be an honor of a lifetime to serve as the governor and make those changes come to be.
Senator Biss, last question for you. You mentioned our beautiful state. What's your favorite place to visit in Illinois?
You know, I have to say Macanda in Jackson County. It's a beautiful, beautiful place not too far from Carbondale. And I've had a chance to get to know Sheila Simon really well. She's a friend and a supporter of our campaign, and it's the place that she grew up and a place that I really, really enjoyed spending time.
Daniel Biss is a state senator representing Illinois' 9th Senate District. That includes parts of Chicago's North Side and the northern suburbs, including Evanston, Wilmette, and Northbrook. He lives in Evanston. Before that, he served one term in the Illinois House. He was also a math professor at the University of Chicago, and he's one of six Democrats running for governor. That does it for us today. As we said, the primary is on March 20th. Joining us on tomorrow's program will be Democratic candidate Chris Kennedy. All of these interviews are archived at our website at 21stshow.org if you'd like to go back and take a listen to them. That's where you can also find past shows, as I said, and also directions for Alexa, NPR One, how to follow us on social media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.